Ladies and gentlemen, I think we can start. Thanks, honourable members, for joining us. Help us navigate the bill through. let me just have my papers before me. Can we just have two things now? I must check my procedure because Shireen here is my leader in this matters of procedure here. I have no clue about it. So when I need support, you must know that's because I have a resident expert here on how I should go about my work. We start with this and all right. Now, I'm instructed that I should start with the motion of desirability, local government municipal property rates amendment bill. You have that piece with you? Did you circulate? Okay. But this is a paragraph anyway. And the motion reads in the following manner. They are to amend the local government municipal rates act, property rates act 2004, so as to provide for the extension of the period of validity of evaluation roll and supplementary evaluation roll that was in force before the commencement of the act, and to provide for matters connected therewith, and that the bill before the committee be taken as a basis. Is that okay? Agreed to? Okay, thanks. Now, members, let's go through the bill itself.
Chairperson?
Yes, Johnson.
I'm Clarence Johnson of Salga.
Yes, sir.
I was asked to attend this meeting only on the question of urbanization.
Yes.
And I don't want my presence here to constitute a formal consultation or participation on the property rates.
Yes.
With Salga.
Yes.
So that it does not, you know, is being inferred that Salga was present when
yes.
the portfolio committee discussed the matter.
Yes. You were present. We will take it you are saying that you were not. I'm just putting it more accurate.
What I'm referring to is the formal participation or consultation.
Okay, let's deal with that in the first place. Did you have a view on the matter that you did not express as Salga? And even if it is not official, do you want to tell us about it so that we are mindful of it?
No, Chairperson, I don't have a mandate to speak on the matter here. That is what I want to convey to you.
Yes, we discussed this matter in the last week when we were here discussing this matter. And we left it from finalizing it on the grounds that it was not yet tagged, and so we needed to tag it. We were under no impression that you, Salga, had not been part of the discussions. The briefings we received was that Salga had been consulted on the matter by the department, and the department is here. I would like them to confirm that, in other words. We ourselves have a responsibility to do so if there's any need on this matter. But I just want us to have that common understanding as we proceed to look the bill clause by clause. Any indication to the contrary, the department? Yes, ma'am?
Chair, Salga was consulted.
Yes.
And they have expressed a view on the substance of this bill.
Yes.
The view was that they were in favor of the substance of the bill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did they do it in writing?
They did it in writing, yes.
Okay.
You will, well, they did do it in writing in the context of a piece of regulation that we were implementing at the time. However, they voiced their desire for an extension of
yes.
the period of validity of old valuation rules. They did do that.
Okay. Let me ask members now. Members, what is your view on what Salga has just said now and what the department has said? Do you have any view on that? Peter, you raised your hand. Was it on Alavi?
Not on that.
Okay. Domen?
Chair, no, it's just for me a disappointment that it's not stated normally in the legislation at the end. It must be stated who was consulted. So does it after short title and commencement?
Memorandum. It's stated.
Oh, I've got my pages are not correctly stapled here.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I mean, if that
page
changes.
Wait a minute. Honorable Johnson, on page 4, bodies and organizations consulted. This is by the department, okay? Now, when we state that the department consulted, we are not thereby saying that as a committee we should not have consulted SALGA. All right? On our own, independently, we could do so if the need arises and so on. The basis on which we proceeded was that there was agreement with SALGA. We interacted with SALGA. We understood that it was consulted. There was no opposition to this. And and that because it is merely an extension, that it did not constitute a substantial issue on which we are going to be in trouble with SALGA about it, that in fact we had agreed because there's a piece of legislation, including this one, that is going to come before us for review, the Property Rights Act itself, at which time we will then conduct appropriate consultations across the board. So that's the base on which we proceeded with it. So this is why I think this is an important issue to raise, so that we do that. But we will note what Johnson is saying. He wants to. Can I use French in the parliamentary committee meeting? In project management, it's called cover your ass certificate. He's just drawing our attention to the fact that he doesn't want to be hanged on the basis that he was here and he didn't protest. Okay. We will consider your certificate recorded. but it's an important principle, I think, generally, to appreciate that. We are quite sensitive to this issue. And in fact, as I was thinking about this procedure this morning, I thought one of the decisions the committee is going to make, even before the department itself brings the Property Rights Act for consideration, for review, and so on, we will ourselves invite people as part of our program, Shirin, to make submissions for us for a review, if necessary, and in what manner. So we will undertake that process ourselves. We don't have to wait for the department to do that, so that when they do come with that stuff, we act on it. We are aware of the many, including traditional leaders who pointed out to us they had concerns about it, but municipalities in areas where they felt that part of the, for example, part of the difficulty of implementation lies in the legislative requirements for who must do the evaluations and so on. There are issues related to that and other matters that require serious consideration. So we undertake to, at the earliest opportunity, invite municipalities and others interested in this matter to make submissions to us on the Property Rights Act. So that's the undertaking we are making. Yes, Honorable Domen?
Yeah, Chair, no, I'm not clear now. Chair, I agree with you that when the department consults,
yes,
it's their consultation.
Yes.
They come and play open cards with us. They
yes.
tell us who they've consulted.
Yes.
They can even make those consultations available to us.
Yes.
But that is their process.
Yes.
Once we get the bill, we
yes.
take our own decision.
Yes.
Whether we want to consult the same people or ask for submissions and so on.
Yes.
Now, my point is just that I have it that this is a sort of a very clear issue that we don't need further consultation, that we approve this bill, but
yes.
you are saying that in future,
yes,
because the only problem I have with you is we can't approve the bill now and promise we will have consultations afterwards to get views on this.
No, it's not on this. It's
okay.
on the Property Rights Act.
Oh, the Property Rights
Act
in totality. Okay.
Yes. What, and also as part of background, this bill, by the way, comes to us as a result of our request as a committee. In the presentation earlier on this year, we drew the attention of the committee to the concerns about the number of municipalities that had not complied with the legislation and asked the department to tell us what they're going to do. And so they have brought this bill before us. So in a sense, it's a response to the committee's request for dealing with this situation. So this has been done. And secondly, as you correctly point out, in our opinion, and I always want to maintain this point, Domen, it is our opinion that it's a simple matter. Others may not think so. But we have discussed it and come to the agreement that we think this one does not require any further consultation. We will, however, when we look at the broader act as a whole, insist that we have full consultation on the Property Rights Act as a whole, not just this amendment. So that's agreed. Okay. Thank you very much. Let me go through, Oh, Peter? Yes, you want
to? Yeah, I know you're going through the adoption process, but I just wanted to see if you'd entertain a question.
You do. You go ahead. No,
because I was abroad when you discussed
this. Is the problem of, the coach Santana calling a team and Benny is overseas, refuses to come, and comes when he wants to come. So now we must open the space for that. No, go ahead, Peter.
Now that's a delightful name. I'm very happy with the content of the. I'm happy with the content of the bill. But it's just on condition that the information that we have underpinning the extension is correct. Now, effectively, you've got an 18-month extension because by the time this thing becomes law, another 6 months would have gone. And from this list here, we have a mere 13 municipalities which have not complied with the valuation requirements. And on the basis of these 13, I think the extension to 6 years is fine. But I want to be very sure that it is only 13 and not a lot more, because my understanding was that the problem was a lot worse than this. There are a lot more municipalities that had failed to comply with the valuation requirements. So, if this is correct, then I'm happy. But I want to be really sure this is correct.
Well, like we said last time when we were here, that this information is based on our information with interactions with the provinces. And you will recall that at some stages when the parliament started raising questions, at that stage we talked, for example, around 15 and all. And things have changed, and hence you got to this 13. But that is the best information we have according to what the provinces are telling us. But another way to look at it, because in the bill, it doesn't say 13 municipalities. So even if it's more than that, even if the information is not accurate, those municipalities will be covered. But as far as we know with provinces, this is the information is 13 municipalities.
Peter, for that question, it's important that we know what is the extent of the ill compliance, if I may use that word. Thanks. Members, okay, let's now go to the bill, clause by clause. I think the first part is to amend the. This one. Which one are you using? The same. Oh, okay, the same. Okay, yeah. Okay. Oh, yes, ma'am. When?
Mr. Chair, I accept the explanation. However, at the last meeting, we were told that there were 17 municipalities. Now, what happened to the other four? Have they fallen off the list or what?
Go ahead.
Chair, I think we did say 17 at the time. What we also admit is that this information is fluid. It changes based on information coming in, based on further assessment and looking at the quality of valuations and so on. That's why between last week and the time that we sent this information, there were some changes, there were certain verifications. Hence, even this 13 that the Honorable Mr. Smith is talking about, we're not married to it necessarily, but we're saying this is the basis. This number gives us a basis for which to say we need to protect these municipalities. things may emerge where you might have one or two others, but they will be protected by this provision.
In other words, what you are talking about is that the provinces, in making the assessment of compliance with the Rates Act, have come to the conclusion that this is the number so far. And but you are saying that they might well come back and say a different story. What more?
They might well do that.
Yes.
We might well also do investigations and find further information that might change this number.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Wenger.
Just a follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Could this committee please be informed if that happened?
Okay. No, that's okay, yeah. In other words, that's important. We just want to make sure that the, even if the law itself does not have a number, but the extent of the problem is important for us to understand, that we would like to have as accurate as possible as possible. So when we dealt with an observation was made and the department confirmed that some of the reports to the department, the annual reports, Section 48, I think it's 47 reports, for them to comply with 48, Section 48, were works of fiction. So we don't want that. So this is why it is important that we verify the extent of the problem, so that we make sure that the numbers that we are talking about are accurate and so on. So let's do that. Yeah, Councillor Johnson, you see...
Chair, may I be requested to recuse myself from the meeting? The information, you know, I'm tempted to participate. And I don't have a mandate. I have other information. Yes, some information now being put through before the committee that that National Treasury could have a different view on.
Let me make this plea. If you have another information and you want to put it and you think it will benefit us, I want to ask you to put it to the committee and not recuse yourself. That's I think it is not in the interest of SALGA, nor in the interest of municipalities, nor in the interest of this committee, for you to sit there with information that might help us understand things differently, and you don't tell us on the grounds that you don't have an official mandate. So SALGA will not hang you, nor will we hang you, for telling us information that you may not have been mandated to tell us. Tell us what you know.
Chair, my problem is that I did not have any documentation except urbanization when I entered the room.
No.
And the issue of the bill now before is now new to me. Now, information, I'm sitting here, and I know that for a fact that National Treasury, we should have been here to either validate on fresh information by the director, intergovernmental relations, to verify this, because recently information was put before us regarding the matter of the financial viability of municipalities, which has got a direct impact since property rates is the only secured income source, that we requested them to provide us with that information. Now, I've only received all the documentation regarding property rates, the bill that was given to me, and this document. So the problem that I'm having is that how do I participate effectively with knowing that there's some other information that I should have had in preparing myself properly as SALGA to participate in the discussion before the Portfolio Committee at the moment?
To give you a chance to speak, and then I'll rule on this matter.
Yeah, I want to address the matter which SALGA is raising about National Treasury. If you look at the bodies which we said we have consulted as a department regarding this bill, we mentioned National Treasury. And the issues of National Treasury and our department is part of the executive issues amongst ourselves. And I will be saying this, which I should not be saying, but we have to start saying these things because of the things which we are starting to get from SALGA. This bill, it went to Cabinet. Cabinet requested us to go back to it because of some of the issues. You will recall when the minister was here, he made a particular reference to the fact that the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform has made, in his words, comprehensive proposed amendment regarding the bill which you were talking about when we'll have to come back on the review of the bill as a whole. But apart from that department, and that was not talking about this bill, I think about the Act as a whole when we review it. But on this particular thing, National Treasury had some other issues, and it was more on legal drafting, which we have dealt with those issues with the Office of the Chief State, Law of Chief State Attorney. And it was more on the issues of legal drafting, not on the substance, on the content. And National Treasury is on board on the thing. So I just want to dispense with that particular matter when SALGA raises issues of National Treasury.
Yes.
For example, if you look at the very same memorandum, I'm not so sure if SALGA has read the thing. On item 5, there is something there which talks about financial implications for municipalities. And in black and white, it says, if approved, the bill will allow for raise in terms of the old order valuation rolls to form part of the 2009 and 2010-11 municipal budget, subject to the necessary exemptions to the various clauses in the Municipal Finance Management Act being secured. It's there in black and white, and those are some of the processes which these two departments are aware of some of those issues. So I'm just saying these things because National Treasury is being brought here to bear.
Okay.
And if it had issues, it should be here, but those issues are the issues. So Cabinet has approved the things, taking into account what each central government department has made known to itself. So I'm not so sure why these issues of National Treasury.
Okay.
But it seems SALGA is responding on other things which are not relating to this particular bill. So there is a confusion which SALGA is bringing into this particular thing.
All right. Yes.
Chair, I don't know if I may add this as well, just to touch on the issue of numbers, because SALGA is making reference to dispute about the numbers. National Treasury does not collect information on this matter, on valuation roles and whether they are prepared. They rely on our department to do that. And the information that National Treasury has on the readiness of municipalities to implement the Property Rates Act is the information that we have given to National Treasury. Any other information that National Treasury collects is on the basis of municipal budgets, municipal financial viability, and so forth. And the report that he's referring to, we are aware of it. It's a report that the National Treasury has done and is taking through the executive about the state of municipal finances and the position they're in from a financial viability perspective. There are no other numbers that National Treasury has on the number of municipalities that are not in a position to have implemented the Act on 1 July.
Okay, let me make this, sorry, ma'am, let me make this clear. Councillor Johnson, I'm afraid I'm going to have to accept your recommendation that we recuse you from the debate on this issue. You are not informed. You did not have material before you in time to be able to comment. Your colleagues had that opportunity. They provided that information to the department, which gave us assurance about it. We as a committee are satisfied that the nature and substance of what we are deciding here is not going to be affected in any substantial way by any information that you may have or not have. We are satisfied that the matter before us is doable and that the committee will proceed to approve the bill as presented before us. If you still feel otherwise aggrieved by the procedure of how you were not informed or otherwise, let's discuss it and we will take it further from there on. Is that okay?
It's in order.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks. Okay. We go to clause 1 on the amendment of Section 89 of Act 6. Any objection to that clause? Is that okay as it is? Just take it that you've read it and you have no objection. Is that okay?
Yes.
Clause 2 on transitional arrangement.
No objection. Agreed to.
Clause 3, that's the short title, and commencement. Agreed to. So, let me then also read the report of the Portfolio Committee on Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, Local Government Municipal Property Rights Amendment Bill, dated 6 October. The Portfolio Committee on Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, having considered the subject of this bill, referred to it and classified by the joint tagging mechanism as a Section 75 bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill with proposed amendments. What proposed amendments? No, we've made no amendments to the bill. So you amend this thing, it's wrong. You anticipated that we would amend the bill. We haven't. Sorry to disappoint you. Sorry? Yes. Without amendments, that's all we're going to say. Without amendments, so you kill the proposed. It's without amendments, yeah. Yeah, and that's it. Any objection to the report? Okay, agreed to as amended. Thank you very much. We've dealt with that issue. There's your bill, Sherine. You can process it as you normally do. Ladies and gentlemen, we move to the next item on our agenda, which is that in our discussion with you remember you stick around here with us, yeah, okay. Yeah, no, don't worry. Take care of them, yeah. We in the discussions that we had with the department, in the presentations that they placed before us, we felt concerned about as a committee, but also in our interaction with the department, not having had enough time to consider, and I think as a country as a whole, I don't think appropriately we have considered the impact of migration and urbanization, especially on municipalities, but generally in the services that we provide as a country, provincial and national departments and so on. For example, the whether we employ or do not employ people who are coming from outside the country, the potential they have to make a difference in the quality of life of the places they are now making their home, even if they are not documented, some of them, and those who are documented. So these issues are important for us to examine, and this is why we felt that the department must at least do that. The department did do a brief presentation on this matter differently, but SALGA too, we said that we would like to hear how they have looked at it. In fact, the chairperson of SALGA, Amos Mosondo, in speaking both as chairperson of SALGA, but in his capacity as a president of the World Council of Local Government, identified urbanization and migration as one of the key challenges that faces municipalities worldwide. So in a sense, this is the reason why we felt, let's get to hear it and then discuss the issue. So Ashraf, now that you are in the belly of the beast, please lead us.
Chairperson, before Ashraf leads you, may I just make some introductory remarks? Because I was requested as a politician to be here. And as you've correctly indicated, at the moment, the chairperson of SALGA is the vice president of the United Cities and Local Government, which is a subcommission of the United Nations. Father Makachwa is the president of the continental body, the UCLGA, in Africa. And in fact, the challenges faced within sub-Saharan Africa is key to many of the planning issues faced by municipalities, cities, etc., from a planning point of view. Your request comes at a very appropriate time when municipalities are busy preparing the integrated development plans and are also reviewing the spatial development frameworks. The impact of urbanization has had many consequential issues in the planning process for municipalities, both on densities, cultural issues related to the urban lifestyles and so forth, but also for government in terms of its the movement of South Africa of 60% urbanization between the rural and urban divide. In some of our cities, the new residents settling in cities are about, Cape Town, for instance, unofficial figure of about 20,000 people per month. In the city of Mangaung, between 1988 and 1995, a 51% increase, properly monitored. After that, no proper data sets are there. And you can imagine the impact on government resources spent if there is an oscillation between the movement of people within the city to the rural areas. From a health point of view, you start administering TB or HIV/AIDS treatment, the person moves away, and there's no follow-up and follow-through on a patient, just to make you an example how people move up and down in terms of the opportunities that urban centers provide. So in future, if we are looking at how government resources and funding allocations will be, the most poor people we will find where the most rich people are, because that is in your cities. And this is changing the entire landscape of our country. We've requested Ashraf to make a formal presentation as SALGA. We are discussing it within the various organizations that we belong to internationally. Here in Cape Town, we've seen a book being launched by a researcher at UCT, and the African office is based here in Cape Town around especially on studying the impact of urbanization, which I think could be quite beneficial to honorable members of parliament to get to know more the impact of urbanization, climate change, and other matters that have got a serious impact on the planning process from a government point of view. So thank you, Chairperson, for the few the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Firstly, I've been roped into doing this presentation. I have not put it together. Did make some comments on earlier drafts, but Johan Mettler cannot make it, and neither can Siana, and so they've asked me at the next person on the list is available, kind of thing. I hope I do justice to their work. But it's also quite timely, if I might just add, that there are two processes underway that are quite significant. The one, of course, everyone knows about is the National Planning Commission and the implications around that. And, you know, that will have to take into consideration urbanization. And then the other process that's underway is the idea of developing a national urban policy or strategy around urbanization. And as far as I know, there is a paper that's going to be available soon, if it's not out yet, that's going to be available for discussion. The purpose of this presentation, I think, is just to introduce members to the issues and concerns around urbanization and what needs to be considered, and perhaps how municipalities need to begin to take heed of some of these things. Regarding definitions, it's defined as, with regard to migration, a definition of migration, the crossing of boundaries. And from a predefined spatial unit by person changing residence. Now, in that, that means nothing. It basically means that migration means you move from one place to another. It can be in one suburb to another, from one city to another, from one rural area to an urban area, from one country to another. In South Africa, we haven't been too good about collecting data on that, but we do know that migration in South Africa, particularly international migration into South Africa, both legal and illegal, are a reality. We've chosen to turn a blind eye to it and have suffered the consequences of xenophobia, but in reality we've got, in my view, and this is just my view, since the 1990s, a significant increase of people from Africa and Asia, particularly the Sudan, Somalia, the DRC, Burundi, Zimbabwe, some parts of North Africa, China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh particularly. And, you know, migrants play different roles in our society, and we see them particularly in municipalities. We see them particularly in different parts of municipal areas, and we can go outside in the city, walk in the CBD, and you'll see the impact that migrants have had, both as entrepreneurs, as manual laborers, and towards the contribution of the skills base, and the fact that there are people who are highly skilled but are serving as car guards or doing all kinds of stuff is an indication of our inability to deal with the fact that we have people coming to our country rather than their inability to engage with what we have to offer. And at the municipal level, at the municipal service requirement level, those people have different requirements. And you often find that migrants probably are the least resource draining of citizens in municipalities, and that has implications. Urbanization is an increase in an urban population due to migration, due to natural population increases, due to net migration, that is more people moving from rural areas to urban areas rather than the other way around. And of course, the incorporation of rural areas into urban areas. So the example, before the demarcation in 2000, Mr. Chair, Somerset West could have been considered to be a rural area, but it is part of the Cape Town metropolitan area right now. So it's how you define urban and what is urban that also helps in determining what is urbanization. But in South Africa, it's virtually impossible to distinguish between urban and rural municipalities. All metropolitan municipalities in South Africa have rural areas within them. That's very interesting, and it's probably unique to most parts of the world, based on some work I've done for the board, Municipal Demarcation Board, some time ago. But also, because of the demarcation requirements post in 2000, where there was a need to bring together the idea of the one city, one tax base, you had to bring together your African, colored, and Indian areas into one municipality, and you forced to bring in the land in between. And for me, the most perverse example is the East London and Ghansani area, where East London is one end, Ghansani is on the other end, and even the other place, Bishu. And you've got all this agricultural and rural land in between. So Buffalo City Municipality might have the size of a metropolitan area and is going to be declared a metropolitan area, but in reality it's a very small population, but huge spaces of land. So it's a quirk of trying to deal with the spatial implications of apartheid that have determined things. SALGA is presently undertaking a migration study aimed at understanding migration in South Africa, and particularly looking at the implications on municipal planning and governance, infrastructure development, service delivery, how it deals with free basic services, spatial integration, local economic development, how to support indigent and social cohesion. Of course, for me, not having seen it before, the missing bullet there is, how do we embrace it? You know, how do we see what's out there, and how do we use it to develop our own country? A lot of these slides were put together as a result of work done by the CSIR for the presidency in terms of the National Spatial Development Perspective, and I'm sure that members of this committee have been exposed to that. But 95% of the population live on 16% of the land, and those are mostly the red parts. I'm not saying that 95% of the country are urbanized, because a lot of that land is not necessarily urbanized. But it generates, those, the red parts generate 92% of the formal economy, constitute 92% of the formal economy. And three quarters of that population live in high density areas. And these are your high density areas here. Almost a quarter of the population of the former Bantustan areas live in, are in these yellow areas here. And you'll see the slides later on. They are also the most undeveloped parts of our country. Population growth, our metropolitan areas have been growing at the average of about 1.8% per annum. Migration, those are people in urban areas who are there as a result of urbanization, they've moved from rural areas to urban areas. And you'll see, this thing is not very useful, you'll see how the fact that people, that the cities have grown doesn't mean that other towns haven't grown. In fact, my view is that and that's my contribution towards this slide, is the significant growth of large towns. But my view is that large towns such as Worcester, Pietermaritzburg, Bloemfontein, I mentioned the towns, not the municipalities, East London, and have actually experienced urbanization at a higher rate than some of the cities might have, Cape Town, Johannesburg, Durban, and so forth. That's my theory. And the reason I say that is based on work done years ago by a Stellenbosch University professor on precisely this thing, where if you look at the Western Cape, that places like Worcester, Malmesbury, and some of these other places grew at the faster rate than Cape Town. So, of course, Cape Town received more people because of the sheer numbers, but the percentage growth was higher in those other things. And that was for me quite significant. And I'd venture to say that this the same applies to other parts of our country, and I think this slide begins to bear that out. Of course, I mean, this is from South African, that is uneven patterns of growth. You can just see the growth, and you can link it to a decline in agriculture and the growth the changes in agriculture, changes in mining, changes in industrial output, and so forth. And you can see where the growth has been.
What is the decline? Where's growth?
I didn't want to use the word decline. I wanted to use the word changes in economic activity.
Oh.
Okay, this thing is talking about population growth and decline. Okay, I'm talking about if you look at the changes, you'll probably be able to link it to changes in economic output and things like that.
Where is the population decline? The pale greeny blue.
Let me just get this right here. I can't see it properly on here either, but the population decline has been in these areas here. And these are the areas that have been experienced the most decline, and the areas in purple have seen the most increase. Okay. And if you link that to, in my view, if you link that to changes in mining, changes in agriculture, you'll see that that would have been one of the causes to people moving from here to there. That's just the point. City regions, I mean, again, it's attracting young people, very young people, where people in rural areas are sending, I mean, there could be various reasons for it, but I think people are sending their children to urban areas for better education opportunities, better health opportunities, and so forth. Again, with the decline of rural economies, the opportunities in urban areas are certainly seen to be better, and where people are prepared to experience, and this is work done by Urban Landmark, actually, quite recently, where they say that where their research has shown that people are prepared to live under very difficult conditions in townships in urban areas, such as shacks and slums and so forth, because of what they can access: better education, better health services, better social services, and so forth. So, and the idea is to look ahead. Say, look, if I'm in an urban area, I can access better education, and my future will be a better one. So, I'm prepared to accept the conditions under which to live right now, which raises very important policy issues on housing. Should government be providing the kind of housing it is in the wake of that kind of research? But that's another question. But it's an important question, and I think these are the questions that are beginning to be asked in the paper that I referred to earlier. That's hopefully going to be released soon, and also that the National Planning Commission is going to be forced to ask. Once it gets established, if it gets established. Poverty concentrations. these are your main grant-receiving areas, and you can see where the underdeveloped parts of our countries are, but also the fact that your cities are attracting people who require grants and so forth. This is simply a graph that shows that where a lot of services are being delivered, and you'll see the concentrations are in those areas where urbanization has been highest. What are the main challenges? Well, the continued challenges. Migration appears to drive the establishment of smaller households. In other words, there's new family formation, not simply because of within urban areas, people, you know, the growth of the nuclear family, but you're finding people, not entire families moving from rural areas to urban areas. You've got new families being formed from rural areas into urban areas. That there's a need in that context for sustainable human settlements, and it's not developing evenly across the country, and then the need for resources to be targeted to those areas of greatest need. The argument is that if the metros and the secondary cities, the ones I referred to earlier, are attracting the greatest amounts of people, then the types of settlements we need to provide need to be focused in those areas. That's the debate. And I personally agree with that argument, but I know that there are people who disagree with that. That there are limited resources at the local level to deal with growing demands for housing and basic services, and it leads to illegal land use, occupation, poor health conditions, and tenure insecurity. And then there are the problems associated with settlement upgrading. I think we've seen that a lot of the issues service delivery protests recently is about upgrade and spending money in particular areas, and some people feel that they don't get it and others get it and so forth. That there is no instrument to track migration, and so we can't plan. I mean, if you don't know, there's a classic example which I always find classic when I go to a place like Swellendam. You'll find a lot of people there are migrants from other parts of Africa, but if you look at the planning for a place like Swellendam, doesn't even mention those people. Now, those people are sitting there selling wares, selling second-hand clothes, selling artifacts, selling all kinds of stuff, playing some role in the local economy, are probably not in the housing waiting list. When they go to a clinic, they probably have to pay for it themselves, don't access a lot of the free basic services, but they're just not there. They're there, but they're not there. And I think that's a weakness in our planning system. We think that the commitment to meet, to upgrade all informal settlements by 2014 is going to be a problem. It's unlikely to be met under the current policy environment. There's a need for a development planning system that ensures that land is demarcated for specific use, and when land is used in that way, to expedite the development of such land. And the delivery of human settlements straddles the functional mandate of the three spheres of government. The idea of the need to devolve functions, to review the powers and functions of provinces and local government, becomes increasingly important if you want to rethink urbanization and migration. The figures are rising in terms of the number of people living in cities and towns. But at the same time, there are people who live in municipalities which are generally rural, the ones which we saw there. And those municipalities are where the old live, the very old, the ill, people who have been retrenched from urban, from factories and so forth, go back to rural areas, where the very, very young live. And those municipalities are sitting with huge service delivery challenges, which they are delivering at the moment, many of them. And I did a paper for Treasury last year on precisely this matter. We are delivering world-class services in these municipalities where people are not only not paying, but the municipality can't even afford to maintain those services moving forward. And municipalities are also sitting with responsibilities of health and education and social welfare, which are not part of their functions, which they have to deal with as a result of that. Again, deals with the issue of powers and functions. Cities and towns are the most productive parts of our country, but nearly two-thirds of the country's population live under the minimum living level. That deals with affordability of services. The fact that people are not paying for services has as much to do with the fact that they are unable to pay for services rather than unwilling to pay for services. I'm not saying that it's pervasive, but that's an issue to be considered. And when you deal with urbanization and the urbanization of the poor, and you're delivering a particular type of service and you're expecting people to pay for that service, I think we're living on cloud cuckoo land in that respect. And in that context, we don't really understand what people want. And government policy of free basic services, housing, that's what dominates discussions in IDPs, Councillor, and rather than how people experience what their own development should be. Cities and towns are also under immense pressure to deliver those services under an expanding population. This population has different needs. That's the point I'm just making, but we're not hearing those voices. I think the conclusions that cities and towns are experiencing infrastructure bottlenecks, which seem insurmountable, which raises the question about whether they're providing appropriate infrastructure in appropriate ways. Migrants are not counted. We need to embrace migration and urbanization, but need to disaggregate the causes to plan and respond appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Asraf. Members, there's the presentation. Very challenging material. Serious implications for the work the country is doing. Any comments, questions? Peter, you don't have to throw your arms here.
No, it's just which one is which?
Okay.
Why did they put a button in the middle? Stupid. No, it's bizarre that you have to extend your right hand halfway across the room. Yeah, Chair, I mean, I enjoyed the discussion. You know, you say the implications for policy and for government, I mean, it's huge. And the thing that strikes me, of course, is this is one of those typical things which is a transversal issue. I mean, with the Department of Housing, you know, Department of Wealth, Social Welfare, Department of Government, no matter what you are, this is an issue that has relevance. And so the kind of overlap, you know, if one adopts a segmented approach, you know, you go in a little sector by sector, it doesn't get you very far. But how does government plan a thing like this, to plan for this in a transversal nature? If you look at this whole rural development now, you know, trying to work out what its roles and functions are in an executive and how that overlaps with all the other ministries, that's, you know, it's quite a problematic thing. And you issue, and then you say, okay, how does government, how do we deal with migration? You know, I think the first thing is you've got to have a sort of very broad discussion across all sectors to identify what the key challenges are and how to address them. And I mean, as a portfolio committee dealing with just one small section of the spectrum, I suppose it's relevant that we do so because it has important implications for local government, in particular. But the discussion would obviously, if it's going to have any policy implications, would have to go way beyond us. But I just want to make an observation. I was actually quite struck. I mean, one of the obvious things that strikes one is the issue of housing and service provision as a consequence of migration. And, I mean, it's often said, if you look at, for example, the problems we're having in service delivery, a lot of it's to do with, a fair amount to do, shall I say, is to do with the fact that our spatial design of cities is such that the unit cost is too high. Your housing is single plots, and when you start trying to service them with electricity and water, etc., your cost is very, very high. And yet we have a very strong resistance, and I understand the resistance to going up. But it may well be that there is no alternative but to go up. But how you do it in a way that is it maintains the notion of community and home as opposed to just housing is a very critical issue. This committee many years ago went to, I think it was Brazil, Curitiba, which is quite renowned for being fairly innovative in respect of your BRTs and all sorts of things, including housing. And they were very good. But I must admit, it's not something... I mean, what one sees very, okay, you've got your gateway started, you know. There isn't much in this country that, in fact, has taken an innovative approach to housing and to deal with this. I was in Turkey. The reason I wasn't here last week, I was in Turkey. You know, Istanbul, the population estimates are, depending on the boundary, is between 12 and 18 million. That's a big place. And I went around quite a lot. I didn't see a single slum, single shack. It's not a rich country, eh? Rich and poor, big extremes, huge wealth, and there's poverty. Not a single shack I could see anywhere when I drove around. Now, the government there has got an approach. I don't know what the approach is. But one of the things that's very noticeable is building lots of high-rise flats for the poor, for migrants, into the cities. Now, it's very good from the point of view of you get shelter, and obviously the unit cost of developing services is cheap. But one wonders whether the consequences down the road are going to be, these are like 15-story flats. You're going to end up with sort of UK, you know, when you end up demolishing them because you create urban slums. So I don't know what the challenge is. I think the challenges are just huge. I don't know where the government has in fact started in any formal sense applying its mind to the problems. I mean, has there, a question one would ask, has there been, for example, a white paper or a green paper on migration issues? Has there been an attempt to see into the future and what the consequences are in respect of government expenditure and planning in the future? I know some hints were made now that the National Planning Commission, I like the if, the if and when, that's quite amusing. But, so Chair, it's something we need to get on with, obviously. Rambling on.
Yeah, Chair, thank you very much. I want to highlight two things. One is that you are stating it as a fact that these migrants have different municipal service requirements. I want to challenge that. I mean, in which way are they different? I mean, they also need actually the same as other citizens. Or what? I went out for a bit. It might have been explained in the very first slide. It is a question of that they're not counted in, but I can't see what is different from what other people need, so I would just like some highlighting on that. And secondly, I want to ask, you said also that a new families are started in the urban areas, not necessarily that the whole family from rural areas migrate, and therefore you have the challenge that you actually, the government double have to provide, that people maintain a house and they demand a new house. Have any studies been done about this, or isn't there a way that we can at least make sure that people don't qualify, say, for grants on both sides, yeah? Housing grants, for example, that we have a system, that we have a check on everyone. I mean, because it's really impossible then you have these riots and demands and government can't provide. So I think there's moving to the cities, but not really moving. And services have to be provided on both sides. That is a real challenge. Thank you very much.
The name that the committee is now called, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, including the portfolio of the department. It's an interesting naming. And this matter we are discussing is actually the heart of cooperative governance. So in a sense, this is where it lies. And if we are to talk about what we are arguing correctly, is that, in fact, many of the, as I think I heard you mention it, many of the problems for which councillors are being blamed today are the responsibility of national and provincial departments. But you are not bold enough to tell us when you say devolved functions, which functions. Now we must guess. Housing, transport, what else? And this is what frustrates me personally. I always hear this argument, but nobody often is brave enough that housing and transport, you must devolve those functions. You are bad at doing it from where you are doing it. They'll be better served at a local level. We want that kind of stuff. What else must be devolved? Municipalities used to handle health stuff. There's a provincialization of primary health care. What is that it? Where do we want this thing to be? Where will they be better handled and so on? So we need some boldness. Saraga is presenting this to us. And so Saraga is left with the lap of the hot staff to handle this issue. So this is why we would want really not wait. Saraga must be bold to put stuff on the agenda so that we see whether we agree with them or not. So yeah, this is a useful presentation, but it's not it's timid. I'm afraid, Councillor Johnson, it's timid. Yeah, it's not bold enough to say, in our collective experience as local government, these are the functions that we think provincial government is bad at delivering. Even if you're going to alienate them, even if you're going to make them angry, but say it. So that's my first challenge, that I do, Saraga, I must remind you that you also promised us an input on the legislative hindrances to service delivery. Remember that, Councillor Johnson?
Yes.
Now, in a sense, this is where it comes in. This issue says, how does the legislation we have to date work against effective governance and delivery at local government, at local level? So a discussion of this matter is an opportunity for us to hear those views. So can you come back to us with that? This is an explicit request. We are in a hurry. We don't want to... this morning I was responding to a question about the timing for the review. Why should we be talking the way we are talking about local government? We've just come from an election. We've just heard during the election campaign, we heard what people are saying about government generally, including municipalities. The white paper on local government got 10 years last year, 2008. Remember that? 10 years. So it's appropriate timing to review things going forward. We've got an election in 2011 coming. So that time after those elections, if we are brave enough, there might be things that we want to do now that will come into place at local and other levels beyond 2011. So I'm just saying the timing is an interesting and an appropriate one. Home Affairs, I told the Deputy Minister some time back that I have been hearing them saying some very useful things about migration and how we should benefit from them. And I see he was with a UNDP person somewhere saying exactly the same thing, that I don't think we have taken advantage in a proactive manner. You know, we went to Belfast, Belfast and other cities in Ireland, and one of the interesting things that we saw was what they called, not necessarily in Belfast, but in another city, I forget what it is, but in Ireland, a passport for refugees. So as a refugee, when you arrive, there's a passport that you receive. Now, all this passport is about is, as a refugee, here's a document that tells you where to get what in the city. So this is the responsibility of a Johannesburg, a Cape Town. Do you have something like that? You don't. Yeah. In other words, you're unfriendly to those who come from outside, who come in either as refugees or as whatever and so on. And so you don't have that. Ireland is very... passionate about language, because the British put their boot on them. They would arrest them if they spoke Irish. And so one of the things they're very particular about, including in their court system, is language. We met a girl from Soweto when we asked, what do you do in Ireland? She says, no, I translate at court. I'm a court interpreter. Because there are many South Africans there, so I speak many of the official languages. So what I do, I'm always called upon to come and interpret, because they are allowed. In fact, it is demanded that they speak in their own language. So there are many South Africans there who speak in their own language and it's interpreted for. That's an interesting system in the justice system in Ireland. Because of their own peculiar issues about language and so on, so they give it priority in how they handle it. So obviously refugees who come here who don't speak French and It's a hell of a job for them to be able to do that, unless you guide them, you know. I'm just citing some of the examples that at a municipal level, there are things that we can do, which we are not doing. I'm just raising that as one challenge, that in specific ways, there's a way in which, however difficult the challenge is, there are things that can be done that are doable at a municipal level to begin the process of what you call embracing them, okay? We are signatories to many pieces of treaties and global agreements that require of us to undertake certain things, okay? At a practical level, they require municipalities to do certain things, but government as a whole to do certain things as well, including around pensions and so on. But I also noticed in your identification of migrants and where they come from, you didn't mention those who are closest to us. You know, my uncles from Lesotho. Okay. They'll kill you for that. From Lesotho, Swaziland, and I wrote them here, Botswana and Mozambique, because they speak our languages. So we don't think they are, we don't often, they are on our, what is this thing that you call the blind side. They are on our blind side because they speak my language, they speak yours, and so on and so on. So we don't see them. Yet they are an issue. You visit the towns that border these areas here, including in Messina and so on. Some of the challenges they are facing are very interesting. No, and Salga would do well to investigate that. You were talking about refugees having peculiar problems. I think those towns that border other countries have problems that we have not begun to deal with, especially around services and so on. So I think it's an area that needs to be visited, and if anything needs to be done, they need to be supported in how to deal with these issues and so on, including around health-related issues. You know, health problems respect no boundaries. Criminals, too, respect no boundaries. And these are priorities that we have, right? And education, there's value in mutual support. The universities in the Free State, for example, almost huge numbers of populations are from Lesotho. The government of Lesotho pays for students there. So a huge student population there and so on. And one of their biggest problems is that they get qualified, there's no jobs for them in Lesotho. And South Africa is very hostile to employing refugees or people from the neighboring country. So the implications of what we are hearing here are huge. And when you also observe that many of the secondary cities, this is the language you use to describe them often, have grown more than the primary cities, it has major implications for their budgets. I've heard councillors complaining about this, that by the time you really announce your budget, what we receive from national coffers, it doesn't take on board how many people actually live here for which we have to provide services completely. So this is the dynamics of this cross-cutting issue, Peter. You are right. It's a cross-cutting issue that requires the cluster systems that we have, all of the clusters together. This is an area that they ought to be looking at and seeing how, in doing our oversight work as committees, the question that we must pester every department, our department that we are responsible for, and others that we will call here, is show us in what way are you taking on board the implications of urbanization in your work. So, and when we do our oversight visit, these are the issues that we should be looking at. How is this city affected by migration and relationship with rural and or other countries and so on? These are issues that we should be posing as a challenge to in carrying out our work. Yes, we I think we need to do more. We haven't, this was just an initial step at the issue, but in the work that we do going forward, members, I think we are going to have to be responsible for generating effective ways to bring up this subject much more than we've been doing in the past. You see,
For example, when a disaster strikes, I've said that nature, issues of health, not respect boundaries. When a disaster strikes, people who often are involved are these documented and undocumented migrants. Okay? And so the rules for providing assistance, if you say there's a requirement for an ID, you're already getting into trouble, okay, with a lot of other people. So our considerations for implementation of the disaster management is a huge one. Implications for these people who they don't get the services that you want to do. Let me stop there and ask you, Ashraf, Councillor Johnson and Ashraf, to respond in any way that you want to. There's no restrictions. This is a discussion. Quick responses,
yes.
And or comments, yeah. But I've tabled a couple of challenges that I hope you can, just as a way of an indication of your commitment, to go back and then come back to us, indicate them. Thanks.
Chairperson, our cities market themselves, the city of Tshwane, a lekker place to be. Umgungundluvu or Mzinduzi, your city of choice, and so forth. So there is a strategy followed by the local government to attract investment, to attract skills, to over-concentration. And I think that this is in the context of urbanization, a key element how cities project themselves within the global community in terms of attracting investment, development to those areas. So we will, in fact, continuously see that mayors are driving it. I think at the time also what you've referred to, the how do we deal with untrackers, people settlers. During the apartheid years, you had the white mayor of the white municipality greeting all the new white settlers settling in the town. We have now what we call the best events or best wishes event. Every year, how we embrace people who have come into a town, meeting also with the business community, and there's a different way of doing things. How we will ensure that we make people to feel welcome after we have embarked upon a strategy on attracting investment and expertise into areas. So the strategy on how do we deal with that we prevent a recurrence of xenophobia is basically at this point in time driven by a few municipalities. There's no general strategy of how we make people to feel welcome in our cities. You said we must think out of the box. If I think out of the box and I think of climate change, and instead of driving from Worcester through the tunnel, I would have gone to the jetty at Tiger Valley and come with a boat here to Parliament if the 2.5 degrees Celsius increase in global warming is going to flood the Cape Flats. That is what's going to happen. We must think out of the box. If I think out of the box, I would have said during the earlier discussion that property rates should be collected by SARS. And not by municipalities, because that is secured income. So the discussion that you have asked us to undertake in terms of thinking out of the box on urbanization or more future planning, or especially spatial development, tests us how we project the future, how we will see what we have now, limited resources, and the Afrikaans word of rentmeesterskap, custodianship, stewardship, is more applicable at the local government level than you sometimes experience, you know, at other spheres. Because there the stewardship and custodianship role comes very much to the fore. So I want to say that on the legislative issue which you have tested, I'm only a street lawyer. I've learned law through the trade unions and through the African National Congress being exposed to it. When we have to deal with the legislative aspects and the obstacles regarding the issue of what are the constraints faced by our country in terms of delivering, we have started discussing it. We've gone to a Lakhotla, and we are busy looking at drawing in also tertiary institutions, reference groups, think tanks. What are these issues that are in fact? So, and some of it, for instance, on zoning planning, etc., we've looked at what is the turnaround time on getting things done in the built environment. In some provinces, it's 3 years. In others, it is 12 months, which means that there's a disjuncture in terms of either capacity in those provinces or the legislative aspects regarding those applicability of those issues which are preventing us from delivery. Lastly, on the issue of subsidiarity, I think that some countries we find that the Department of Environmental Affairs is where you find water, electricity, housing, or health, all the social development issues. Attach those services of government which where the individual or citizen is directly receiving the benefit. And all the others are subdirectors. If there's a need in terms of legislative strategic issues, whether it's a national infrastructure development strategy, which is not there, then we have to look at those areas, how we deal within the context of urbanization, that we equitably distribute without neglecting the rural areas. Because if the flow of people is going to be to the cities, then the pressures on those rural municipalities will increase because it will make them dysfunctional to provide for those high-cost infrastructure in order to sustain people. In Limpopo, we have already those kind of situations where the flow to Gauteng is at such a rapid rate that the infrastructure cannot be be paid for operation and maintenance, even if you introduce new infrastructure. And this is applicable to virtually all the major former Bantustans, whether it's Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, etc. So my appeal is that that you have asked me when are we delivering those responses in terms of legislative review. It's work in progress, and if you setting a deadline, we will seriously attempt to try to meet that deadline on the legislative review process. Thank you.
Okay, I promise to be brief. On the issue of Curitiba and those things, I often think about, I'm also in my another life, I'm the president of the South African Planning Institute, and of course, all planners love Curitiba. But I asked them one question. Would Curitiba have been possible had it all been a democracy at the time? Because they literally went and did things overnight above the heads of people and simply ignored or jailed people who opposed them. And the mayor of Curitiba, Jaime Lerner, was appointed by the military. Same thing with Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, all the other countries that we hold up as beacons, where they have reduced conditions of democracy. So I don't have an answer, but I think that we must just be aware of the context in which some of these countries have been able to do what they've been able to do. And I think I'm actually glad that we have the conundrum of democracy and development, because it's we've got the right and freedom to engage around these kinds of stuff. And, of course, we've got lots of problems. I'm excited about at least having the right to disagree and sitting in Parliament and being able to do so. I mean, that's a significant thing. So that's just a comment on Curitiba, sorry. It's like one of my knee-jerk reactions, you know. I'm sorry about that. But on the issue of people double-dipping regarding getting two sets of services and whether migrants and challenging whether migrants actually also don't want access to free services and things like that. My personal view, and it's my personal view, and I stress that, and I say this as I say this as myself. I question the value to development and democracy of simply giving free services. We are creating our own backlogs, we are creating our own tensions, we are creating our own conditions for our own service delivery, protests and so forth, some of them quite violent. And in that context, we'll never get ahead of the housing problem. We'll never get ahead of challenging urbanization. Urbanization and the challenge to urbanization in South Africa is not about housing. It's not about free basic services. It's about creating opportunities for people. Now, if I were a migrant, and I'm the grandson of migrants, the issue at any point in time is, do you want to live in a secure and safe environment, or do you want to get a free house and free basic services? Because people with skills or some access to skills would rather live in a secure environment and utilize the skills than to get a free house, in my view. And I think those are the challenges we need to begin to address as South Africans. And, Mr. Chairman, I hope I'm not sounding like a member of the opposition. But it's something I believe quite strongly in as a South African. I think we need to begin to look at that. And even in the world's most stable democracies, India, now Brazil, I can't use China, it's not a democracy, but particularly India and Brazil, which are our equivalents in a sense, the issue of free housing and free services is something that is not always there on the agenda. People have to fight for what they have to get, but in places like Brazil, people have to make a contribution towards their own housing and things, and I think that we do South Africans no favor when we offer that service. In terms of moving on, I think that I am very glad, because I'm exceptionally positive as someone who believes in national planning. I've seen it work in other countries. I've read about it, and I've engaged with people around this thing. I'm exceptionally positive about the need for a national planning commission. I think that the need for a body that sets the national vision, that brings all the departments together, even if it plays the role of a policeman, other people might not like that. In the context of a democracy, where there is a body that sets the policy agenda in a democratic way and ensures that agenda is seen through, is fundamental to development and democracy. So, and as a South African, I feel almost relieved that we're going back to basics and re-looking at national planning, re-looking at urbanization, re-looking at migration and so forth. But I think that as a country, we're taking the lessons of the past 14, 15, 16 years and saying, look, we've done work. We've done a hell of a lot of work. How can we do it better? And that excites me as a South African. About the other things that you require of South Africa, Mr. Chair, I'll take that message back.
Okay. Let me start with the democracy story. Ashraf, a review is a review, which means things are up for debate and discussion. So whether your view sounds like the opposition, that's irrelevant. So all I'm saying is that's what a review is, looking at whether it has worked, and if it has, confirm it. If it hasn't, let's consider changing it. So, and as you know, the politics will decide that. So, but it's important that it must be tabled, so we appreciate those sort of views. Secondly, I realize your bias, and I'm not surprised, you see, because Marx always observed that people's location informs their outlook. As a planner, you completely have not mentioned M&E. I mean, monitoring and evaluation. And even if the president put both together, the planning commission and the monitoring and evaluation, then one can't go without the other. It's a pot, a three-legged pot with one of them crippled. So it can't stand. So
please, always check whether my bias here.
Let me put it down in my notes.
Yes, for future reference. In future, we can expect you to say about Pliny. That one we knew you were going to come. What surprised us is not to mention the other parties, you know. And Pliny, without evaluating, doesn't work. So I thought it's an important observation to make. In fact, the result of pointing out whether a policy works or not comes from evaluation. So next time, do mention Collins's outfit, even if he comes from Limpopo. We must remind these Cape Townians that they are not the world, you know. He mentions Travers because they're both from partly Cape Town. Now, he's not even from Cape Town, he's from Devon. Yeah. Yes, Councillor Johnson, Gauteng, according to Stats South Africa, was the recipient of the highest numbers of people, 200,000 to be specific, for a specific period. And the Western Cape was the other one, which is also receiving huge numbers in that order, I think. That's, so it has implications for the work we are doing there. For example, my biggest concern is the climate change, Councillor Johnson. In other words, problems of water. South Africa, we've been told this number of 20 years, in 20 years' time, but I hear it every year, 20 years, it doesn't change. that we are confronting, we are a water-scarce country. We are not managing our water properly. There are serious allegations that because of that big entry into Gauteng that, and other, both industrial and other pollution, water there is in big trouble. They already get water from Lesotho to keep alive, and if they are polluting what they have underground, then there's a big danger. So this urbanization story has implications also for that. I mean, you increase the sort of pressures on all systems, including water and its usage. So unless we go for appropriate and judicious management of water, we will be in trouble. But that's one of the implications, that we have to be careful about that, undertake serious, if you like, green undertakings for the judicious management of water, and be a lot more robust than we have been about that issue to date. Otherwise, we are in trouble. The third point I thought I should raise also relates to Peter, you were asking about whether there is any interesting experimentation around housing. You were not there. Weren't you there at Alex? Alexander? Were you there? That's the place. Incidentally, also one of the observations that they made was that by having pulled together people into this single office to deal with planning issues, they reduced it dramatically to 12 months instead of the usual 18 months. Because they were able to do that way. Apart from the planning, but also the different housing systems they were providing was very interesting to meet the needs of people. I mean, Alex historically has had people who have owned houses and rented them out and so on. So part of the new housing that they are building includes